Nice to see you all. I planned the following, unless the beloved intervenes in a drastic and gorgeous way. I would like to share my thoughts on the path to the beloved with you for about an hour, and then anybody who wants to leave or wants to do anything human can. But I would really ask and beg the rest of you to stay here and do some breathing exercises with me to absorb what I've tried to give you. And then when we have gone through that, then the questions can come so that they come from the fullness of being and not from the head. And then in the last 10 minutes, what I'd like to do for you is to read for you a spray of Rumi poems so that we go out into the noon and into lunch and into the rest of the day irradiated with the joy of the lover. An old Turkish Sufi friend once said to me, terrifying me and putting me on my mettle forever, when I go to hear a person speak about the path, I listen not only to their words, but to the depth of silence and holy passion behind the words. One thing matters to me now more than anything else, and that is that the person who is talking, who is daring to talk of these sacred things, should be fully present, real, naked, calmly exposed, and not in any way hiding. I have discovered, as I'm sure you have, that you can hide in a myriad of ways. You can hide behind learning. You can hide behind a title like master, or teacher, or sheikh, or mystic, or writer, or famous person. You can even hide behind repeated flourishes of sincerity. But true love does not hide, and it does not need any false dignity. True love is transparent. When your cat loves you, it rolls over on its stomach and closes its eyes and purrs in bliss as you stroke its stomach. And when your friend loves you, his or her eyes and body shine. And one of the things I have come to believe deeply is that if I speak to you, to your full human divine self, from my full human divine self, if I speak to the sea of the heart in you, from my sea, then inevitably a small miracle will take place beyond our control. I pray that I will be able to talk to you from this place of true love today, as one divine human being to another, and that our hearts will meet simply and beyond words, and that you will accept both the tenderness and the fierceness of the vivid transparence I long both to be one with and to share. So please pray for me, and please pray for yourselves in the words of the prophet. O God, give me light in my heart, and light in my tongue, and light in my hearing, and light in my seeing, and light in my feeling, and light in every part of my body, and light before me, and light behind me. Give me, I beg you, light on my right hand, and light on my left hand, and light above me, and light beneath me. O Lord, make light grow within me, and give me. and illuminate me. I want to begin by telling you a story about something that happened to me and which permanently changed my vision of the world and gave me one overwhelming clue to the nature of the path to the beloved. When I was 28, I was invited with a group of other rascals and curmudgeons to go by the Israeli government, to go to Israel and tour the holy sites and fundamentally be inoculated with Israeli propaganda. But since that paid our fare, none of us minded being told lie after lie after lie by both sides. I was very lucky in that time because I had as a guide a great Jewish mystic poet, a man whom I shall call Isaiah in the story, who was plump, hilarious, small, bald, and wild. The ideal guide to Jerusalem. And one day, he took me on a complete tour of Jerusalem, expostulating and vibrating by every stone and thrilling me with all his knowledge and with all his amazing Hasidic jokes. We ended at the end of the afternoon in the Garden of Gethsemane, in the place where, as you know, Jesus went through the hardest part. That part where take this cup from me turns into not my will, but your will. And standing in that late sunlight, in that ultimately holy place, where so much has been done for the world, he started to talk of the gate across the way, gate that is in the wall across from the Garden of Olives through which the Holy One, the Messiah, will come at the end of time. And as he stretched out his arm, which was fringed with a very loud Hawaiian shirt, I saw on his arm the numbers, and I knew that this man, who had been filling my whole day with such ebullience and joy, had been in a concentration camp. And he saw me look at the numbers, and he saw my eyes fill with tears, and he said, yes, I was. I spent my childhood in Auschwitz from the ages of 9 to 12. And then he told me this story. He said, there are no words to describe the horror of what I saw as a child. And I am not going to try, because words fail before such monstrous evil and depravity. I saw hundreds of people brutally killed. I saw my own mother raped and killed. I myself was raped and made to clean out a latrine with my tongue by the same God. I went through things that I will not lay upon you now. But in the end, I have come to bless the horror of what happened to me, because it drove me to make a choice at the depths of it drove me to make a choice between two very different worlds. Between the world that I saw every day being enacted in its horror and evil and cruelty and monstrousness and tremendous godless corruption all around me, and the world that I felt burning in the inmost chamber of my heart when I said the prayers that I'd been taught as a child, and when I thought of my mother, and when I thought of the garden where I had lived as a child. And I prayed, 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 month after month after month, that God would show me his face so that I would know in all that horror that, yes, it is true that the divine is real. And God did not show me his face for month after month after month after month after month. There was total silence, and that only made the darkness darker. Until one morning, I woke up with the knowledge that I had to do the choosing. I didn't have to ask God to appear to me. That was wrong. What I had to do was, in the depths of my being, choose which world I believed was really real. And he said that morning, which was a very cold, terrible winter morning, he went out of his hut. He stood out in the snow, and silently, with every cell in his body, he screamed again and again and again, I choose love! I choose love! I choose love! And then he said something amazing happened. The light in reality, the light that is manifesting reality, the light of the beloved, the light of the source came up horizon to horizon. And he saw that everything was saturated with that light, that the barbed wire was glittering with that light, that the snow along the barbed wire was glittering with that light, that the pools of urine were glittering with that light was in everything. And at the very moment that his heart was about to burst, the guard who had raped him and made him clean the latrine out with his tongue came out of another hut smoking a cigarette. And at that moment, instead of feeling rage, instead of feeling rage and terror and horror and fear and vengeance, he felt his entire being constrict in burning compassion for someone who lived so estranged from the rapture and beauty and power of the One. And since that time, he said, there has been a pain of love in the heart of my heart. And since that time, I have known that there is one thing to do on this earth. Every moment, every day, which is to repeat those words, I choose love, so that love can reveal its outrageous and all-encompassing splendor to us. And from that I choose love came a lifetime of poetry, a lifetime of mischief, a lifetime of ebullience, a lifetime of witness, and a lifetime of peacefully fighting to reconcile the Arabs and the Israelis in the midst of that nightmare. He was a holy person because he had woken up to the truth of his own nature. If you were to push me against that wall and put a knife to my throat, I like dramatic. It tends to focus the mind, I find, in a world of wool. If you were to do that and to ask me, what apart from this constant choice of love in the core of my being and your being, I thought were the two most important things on the path, I would say to you, the extreme courage of abandoned trust and a radical, final, and ever-deepening humility. And marrying the two and fusing the two will give you an enormous power to go on and on and on deeper into the love that is your core and deeper into the love that is reality. And in honor of those two qualities, I want to read you the two texts that I keep by my side always to remind me of what this glorious path demands, and what it costs, and what it is. And the first, which honors the extreme courage of abandoned trust, comes from Kabir, a great 15th century poet who lived in Benares, whom the Hindus claimed as a Hindu, and the Sufis claimed as a Sufi. You see, nothing has stopped. but who was, of course, both and neither, wrote this wonderful poem called True Knowledge. And I'd like to fling it out there and to have it dance in every cell of your being, because this is about as naked and flaming a representation of the truth of what's required as you'll ever hear. This, I've discovered, is true knowledge. Those who scramble to get into a boat, they sink like a stone midstream, while the shelterless and the abandoned reach the other shore. Those who dare to take the hard, winding, thorny road will get to town in the end. But those who stroll the easy highway get robbed or even killed soon after they set out. Look, everyone is wound in illusion's web, the so-called holy as much as the worldly, and those who run for safety under the comforting dais of form and ritual and dogma and sect, well, life's hurricane will lash them. Stay out in the open. You'll be left safe and dry. The ones love never savages live in boredom and pain. But those love devours like a cannibal, they live in bliss forever. The ones who lose their own eyes come to see the whole creation blazing in their own light. But those who hold on to their own sight remain blind as bats in full noon. When I began to awake to truth, I saw how bizarre and crazy the world really is. So what Kabir is asking all of us is to fling off our comforting dogmas and rituals, fling off the robes with which we protect ourselves from the nakedness of love, and dare to run again and again and again on the spear of love so that it can open our hearts larger. Dare to run out into the open and be shelterless and be without knowing and be abandoned so that we can have the extreme experience of grace saving us and taking us to a place we never imagined existed. And those lines that he places at the end of the poem so fiercely are the clue to the path. He says, the ones love never savages, they live in boredom and pain. If you want a comfortable path, if you want an easy path, if you want a pain-free path, look elsewhere for the real Sufis. They are not offering you that. They are offering you the experience that comes from embracing the totality of love in all of its aspects, terrible as well as beautiful, death-dealing as well as life-giving, passionately, crazily dark, as well as sublimely, peacefully light. And from that embrace, from that fearless embrace, comes an ecstasy and a bliss which no comfort and no ease can possess, because they are the ecstasy and bliss of the great dancer himself, who is dancing as much for destruction as for creation. The other great quality that we all need on the path, more sometimes I think than oxygen, is one of those qualities that is very, very hard to find, both in ourselves and in the world, so-called spiritual world around us, and that is the radical humility of the saints. I think that you can always tell the depth and range of a person's realization from the extent of their wonder before the beloved, and their wonder at the magnificence and power and grandeur of the beloved. In the one experience that I consider to be an experience in which I saw just the fringe of the fringe of the fringe of the fringe of the glory, I and my whole being fainted away in total agony and terror and bliss. And when people come to you and talk to you about the beloved as if they just met the beloved and strolled with the beloved down some easy highway, and the beloved, of course, has given them some special message that they have to give to you, don't believe them, because the beloved is not so easy of capture as that. And the sight of the authentic beloved reduces you in the core of yourself to someone who is always needed. rapture and awe. And this has never been more beautifully expressed than someone who really, really knew this glory, and that is Rumi. And I beg you to take these words deeply to heart, because they will save your life. Remember always that all mystic sciences and all mystic exercises, all passions and all acts of devotion, in comparison with the real worth and majesty of God, are as if someone came to you, bowed once, performed some perfunctory little service, and then went away. If you were to put the entire earth on your heart in serving God, it would be the same as bowing your head once to the ground. I am not trying to discourage you by saying this, only to instill in you some sense of proportion, some sense of the terrible glory of the one you love. Do you imagine that God's beauty and worth and magnanimity did not precede your worship and service of them? Wasn't it God who made you able to worship and serve God? Wasn't it God who gave you some tiny spark of his great passion to love him with, some tiny flame of his eternal fire of perseverance with which to go on looking for him? So who are any of us to boast of anything? Anything we can do, anything at all, is like making little forms out of wood and leather and taking them humbly to God, saying, I love these little forms, I made them, but it is up to you to give them life. Give them life, and these my works shall live. If you do not, everything is always up to you. Abraham said, God is he who gives life and he who makes to die. Nimrod said, I am he who gives life and makes to die. What arrogance! Because if God wants, the sun will rise in the west and the mountains will vanish like smoke at one rush of God's wind, and all of the seas will dissolve in vapor, and all of the stars will fall out of the sky into a pit of eternal darkness. This is the power, and this is the infinite majesty, and this is the glory of the one we are in love with. Never forget this, or you will be in danger. The path to him is littered with the bones of those who did not remember who they were looking for and how great beyond all concepts and imagining he always is. What you need with this perpetual choice to choose love in the core of your being, with this extreme courage of abandoned trust, and every commitment to ever deepening humility and adoration, what you also need is an accurate map of the path. And you need it because taking this path without an accurate map, is both sober and humbling and exalting at the same time. Without having an accurate map, it is like trying to climb Mount Everest in a tutu, or imagining that you can sail down the Amazon in a paper boat. You can't, you won't. Very soon, you will be defeated. And what I'm going to try now is to distill for you what I consider to be the essence of the Sufi esoteric traditions. They have many different stages. Some of them have 7, some of them have 9, some of them have 11, some of them have 72. They go on and on. But I believe that the stages of the path to love can be distilled into 4 essential stages, and I call them falling in love, engagement, sacred union and marriage, and birthing. And before I try and give you those as I understand them, I would like to say 2 essential things about this path that I have discovered and that all mystics who take this path seriously discover. The first is that it is essential to remember Whatever is happening to you, however strange it may seem, however wild, however incomprehensible, that it is natural. Supernature and nature, divine nature and what we call nature out there, are two sides of the same nature. And the growth of the human being into a divine human being, the growth of the lover into the beloved, the transformation that you go through on this path, wild and insane though it may look at certain moments, has its laws, has its deep, rich, gorgeous logic, has its natural flow, is in its deepest sense profoundly natural. And it's only because we as a culture have lost what I would call the inner sciences, which are the mystical sciences of transformation, that we don't think that this process is natural. But reminding yourself as it happens to you that what is happening to you is not only real, is not only graced, but also totally natural in its place and ordained from the beginning of time as your destiny is enormously important on the path because it gives you the stability and the courage to accept the lunacy of the beloved's treatment. The second thing that I have found to be essential on the path is to take very seriously the distinction that the Sufi mystics make more exquisitely, more lucidly, and more fiercely than any other. The distinction between what is called hal and makam, between mystical states that come and go and achieved levels of permanently possessed consciousness. It is extremely important to know that difference between states that come and go and levels of consciousness that become established. Otherwise, you will imagine that the states are the makam. You will imagine that the elevations and the visions and the dreams and the ecstasies are the enlightened levels of awareness, which they are not. They are glimpses of that awareness. They have to be worked with thoroughly and deeply in the core of the heart through meditation, through prayer, through service, and they have to become a stable, steady, normal possession of your normal awareness if they are to be real. This is very sobering information because what it tells all of us, is that there is always a great deal of work to be done. And having this kind of sobering classical information very firmly in place will help you on the path, because at the very beginning of the path, it will give you a sense of the enormity of what's before you, the glory of what is available to you, and the stages through which you must go to open like the full divine human rose you are. And the lack of this information out there is one reason why this new age is in such chaos. It simply doesn't know the difference between an initiatory dream and superconsciousness. They are different. So let me do what I can to open up for you this path. And I beg you, before I do, not to be either intimidated or afraid of what I'm going to open up to you, because there is nothing to be afraid of. What there is to fear is remaining ignorant. What there is to fear is not having this experience. If I were to tell you that going down the Amazon would be a breeze, and you set out on the Amazon, and suddenly you came to rapids, and then to rocks, and then to waterfalls that fell 1,000 feet, and then to some very nasty natives with blowpipes tipped with curare, you would write me, if you survived the trip, a very fierce letter saying, "You fraud and charlatan, you told me it was going to be wonderful and easy, and then all these amazing things happened to me." What I'm going to try and give you is my real map of what the Amazon looks like as far as I've been able to come down. And with the limitations of my own temperament and personality. I think that we are born here, as Wordsworth said, trailing clouds of glory. And the Sufi mystical tradition roots these clouds of glory in the pact of Alast, in the witnessing of the Lord that happened in pre-existence, that is mentioned in Surat 7 of the Quran. The Lord said to all creatures before they were created, am I your Lord? And they all witnessed yes. And that yes is imprinted in us as two things: divine consciousness itself, waiting to be explored and revealed, and also the commitment to reiterate that, yes, I choose love, I choose love, I choose love, every single moment of our existence. We have made that commitment before we come here, and we are stamped with the gold of that commitment. But what happens very early on in all of our lives is that we create what psychologists call a false self, a self that is the result of trauma, neurosis, the expectations of family, the expectations of school, the expectations of religion. And that false self becomes the self that we identify as our true self. And in a culture like ours, which is dedicated almost wholly to the pursuit of the false goals of the false self, to sex, drugs, rock and roll, power, and money, it's very, very hard to see beyond that dark and suicidal self-identification of ourselves with the very thing that is imprisoning us from the sacred knowledge of our own splendor, of the yes that is imprinted in us with letters of fire and gold. So what usually happens, and let's be honest here, very, very few of us go through the portals of the false self gracefully. What usually happens is that we have a breakdown. And my desire for everybody on this planet is that they have a really good, solid, no-holds-barred breakdown, preferably between 18 and 25, because if it happens then, there's a chance that the habits of the false self have not been so solidified that they cannot be irradiated by real knowledge. If it happens later, it's more complicated, because you've been in this fictive dream of yourself for a while, and you rarely believe the messages that your world has been given you of yourself. So have your breakdown young, and know that that breakdown is not a breakdown. This is crucial. Why the map is so important is that when people come to this moment, when they lose a great love, or they go bankrupt, or they realize that the job that they wanted to do for all their lives is an absolute pest of a nuisance. I got this breakdown young because I was elected a Fellow of All Souls at 21, which is supposedly the greatest academic honor in England. I was surrounded by supposedly the most famous, the most celebrated, the most intelligent people of my time, and I wondered, what could it possibly be about if it was all about ending up like these people? Oscar Wilde said, if you want to punish somebody, give them exactly what they want, because then they will see how pointless it really is. If you realize that this shattering, and we haven't even begun the real path yet, is an invitation to seriously dive into an exploration of your divine nature, and if you begin really to look, and if you really start that great process which has to go right through the path of stoking the fire of inner longing for the beloved, then I promise you, you will be given what you need to make the next step. It may arrive in a series of initiatory dreams. It may even be a vision. It may be a book falling off a bookshelf in a bookstore and hitting you on the head and opening at a passage which speaks directly to you. It may be meeting someone a little further along the path, an adept who can radiate some small radiance of the beloved towards you so that you know that it is true and that it is possible. And with those dreams, if you deepen them, and with those experiences, if you deepen them, begins the first stage of the path, the stage which in many mystical traditions is called the honeymoon stage, and which all mystics who go through it look back at with regret for two reasons. It is so sweet. It is so beautiful, the moments when you feel the energies in your body, the moments when the landscape starts to radiate with light, the moments when your heart opens and feels the beloved. That's the first reason why it's so beautiful. And the second is, of course, that you think you're already enlightened. Because the difference between what you're experiencing now and what you've experienced before is the difference between prison and Covent Garden. It is a wholly new life that's beginning. And there we have met the first great temptation of the path, one that will recur again and again through the path, the temptation of inflation. One of the greatest saboteurs of progress on the path is the voice that tells you, I don't think that Jesus ever experienced anything quite like this. And this must be what Rumi felt when, etc., etc. No, what is starting is the very beginning, the first little fresh green leaves on the sprig that you are. And that is why, if you pass through that inflation, what you must develop at the earliest stage of the path, and please don't fiddle around by this, you must develop a spiritual practice, because only a sincere, humble, daily, incessant, no-nonsense spiritual practice can prevent you from that voice taking you over, because that will always ground you in the reality of the necessity to go further and in the reality of the presence, which totally transcends anything that you think that you may have realized of the presence. And if you allow your falling in love to be a real falling in love, a falling in love that truly honors the beloved, that truly is absolutely swept away by the glory and beauty and power and bliss and passion of the beloved, and is not concerned about how you look in the mirror before you go to meet the beloved, then what the beloved will reward you with is the first great ordeal of the path. And one very important thing to remember about the path is that what we think of as ordeals and terrors and horrors are not those at all. And many times they're not even punishment. What they are extreme forms of grace radiated towards us directly in exactly the right way so that we can wake up and take charge of our destiny under God and make the leap into the next stage of our evolution. And it's essential all along the path to know that as you know that you are breathing in and out, and to fix that knowledge very, very deeply in the heart, because you are going to need it. The first great purification that takes place in the path is the purification of all of the senses, so that instead of being the servant of the false self, they can slowly, painstakingly and gorgeously become illumined by the light of the secret divine self. And during this period, which can be very harsh, very fierce, which can demand an enormous, which always demands an enormous surrender to the beloved, please help me, please support me, please sustain me, please keep me awake, please give me the strength I need to go through it. During this period, what happens is that the divine light in reality slowly starts to come up. Slowly. At first it's just speckles, and then it is auras, then all kinds of marvelous dreams and initiations happen, and slowly, 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 you realize that your mind at its core and your heart at its core are connected with the light heart of the universe. And this is an astounding moment, because you know now that everything that you've ever read in all of the mystics about being the supreme truth, being one with divine consciousness, is not poetry. It is real. And if you work with this initiation, and if you go on purifying the mirror of your heart, you will be graced the first great awakening experience of the path, which is an experience of the overwhelming unity of your being with the divine being in a blaze of light. And you will know when that experience happens to you, that you and the light and the core of creation and creation itself are one in one overwhelming, glorious fire dance. And that knowledge will end forever one journey, the journey to God, and begin another and boundless journey, the journey in God, which then starts to foment its passion within you in the second stage, which I call engagement. This stage is not enlightenment. And in fact, one of the things that I have discovered, and all mystics on this path discover, is that there is no such thing as enlightenment. What there is an enlightenment field in which you enter to be stretched, expanded, boundlessly forever and ever and ever. And not just in this body, but in all the other bodies that you take in all the other dimensions. It goes on and on and on because love is infinite and the developments and transformation within love are infinite. So that forever rubbles all human pride, doesn't it? And all human claims to exclusive divine authority. It forever and ever rubbles them. Because what I will hope to reveal to you as the path continues, is that the further you go into this outrageous knowledge, necessarily the humbler and more concerned and more of a slave of love you have to become. Let's go back now to this amazing experience in which the universe reveals its true face of light, and that face has your slightly strange features on it. What actually happens after that experience is that this light consciousness becomes a normal possession. And being constantly in connection with it divinizes all of your creative emotional powers, all of your gifts, slowly but richly and passionately. And you, at this time of the path, can find yourself wildly charismatic, able to attract all kinds of people, able to speak brilliantly, able to write in ways that you never imagined you could write, receiving direct messages from the divine. Now you can hear, if you are listening, the great danger that is inherent at this stage of the path. Each great awakening has a great danger. The first has the danger of thinking you're already Jesus when you're just about to start seeing the fringes of the fringes of the light. The second stage has the tremendous danger which very few people avoid. And in fact, I can speak with authority about all these dangers because I've avoided none of them. That's what gives me, I think, my appalling awareness of them. The second danger is the danger that is symbolized in all of the secret mystical traditions by the temptation. And the temptation always is, are you going to use these powers for your glory or for my glory? Are you going to devote everything that you are secretly to your own fame, to your own power? Because you can now have almost anything. You can mime the divine powers, you can have occult powers, you can appear in people's dreams, you can transmit a certain modicum of mystical power, you can actually appear to those who know nothing about the path as if you were almost divinized. So you are given the supreme temptation on earth of actually miming the divine. This is what Jesus is given by the tempter in the desert. And unfortunately, there are many unscrupulous gurus and masters and sheikhs who have, over the course of time, succumbed to this temptation, who have used the occult powers that it gives them to dominate and ensnare and enthrall. Rumi goes on and on about this. Ramakrishna goes on and on about this. Hafiz goes on and on about this. Attar goes on and on about this. It is essential that all seekers know that these powers are there, can be used against them, can be used to enthrall them, can be used to seduce them, can be used to keep them the prey of unscrupulous black and occult magicians, so that you know that when you come to that moment yourself, you will refuse with everything in your body to have anything to do at all with the filth of power. And you will choose to be the servant and not the Lord. That if you choose to be the Lord, your lordship will be annihilated by God, because God will not be mocked in the end. And if you choose to be the servant, all the treasures of the divine will be opened unto you. There is a wonderful Sufi story that goes right to the heart of this choice that happens in the second stage. The emperor, the great emperor, Mahmud, is in love with a slave. And he decides to find out if this slave really loves him, because he really loves him and he thinks he's wonderful and he thinks he can really trust him. But how can you ever know in this world? So he invites the whole court to this vast room that is full of jewels and deeds to Marin County Estates and God knows what, and which I long to have, but everything is there. Everything is there. Everything that you could possibly want. And there is no reason why you shouldn't want any of those gorgeous things in that room. None of them is sins. This is what makes the story